Welcome to the Job Shop Show, where we talk with the owners, suppliers, partners, and customers of custom manufacturers. Listen and learn the secrets of top-performing job shops, the tools, techniques, and backgrounds that have made them successful, all in the quest of raising the bar for custom manufacturing. I'm your host, Jay Jacobs. This episode is sponsored by Paperless Parts, connecting buyers and suppliers of custom manufactured parts. The Paperless platform is a secure, ITAR-compliant, cloud-based manufacturing system for suppliers that reduces the amount of time spent on sales, estimating, quoting, administration, and order processing. It offers seamless integration with the accounting and ERP software tools that shops already use, such as QuickBooks, E2, and JobBoss. Paperless Parts was founded with a mission to make manufacturing more accessible by streamlining the quote-to-cash process. Spend less time quoting and more time selling.
Hello, Job Shop Show podcast listeners. We've got a fun show for you today. We are going to dive deep with Jordan Amoya, partner and owner of Aurora Machine. Aurora is a machine shop that has grown quite rapidly from 4 to 40 employees in just 6 years. Lots of good nuggets to explore in how they did it. Welcome to the Job Shop Show, Jordan.
Thanks, Jay. Excited to be here.
So I want to start off with a picture I noticed on your website of you and your brother, and you were wearing a very cool and different watch. What is it, and what's the story behind it?
It's a calculator watch. I was basically looking for something. I'm a functional guy by nature, So just looking for something that, you know, I could basically not worry about if it breaks or falls off or gets wet. So I was also looking for something that I could be on the floor and then also do like quick arithmetic. Mm-hmm. So naturally fell into the $20 Casio watch from Amazon.
Wow. And did you actually use it on the floor with the calculating functions?
Not as much as I would have liked. Probably only a handful of times, but It was cool while it lasted. I ended up giving it actually to my nephew, who still has it to this day. That was about 4 years ago. I've upgraded since to the iWatch, and life is a little simpler with the iWatch than the calculator watch.
Can you do calculations on the iWatch? Or do you just
Siri
talk
does.
To it?
Be like, yeah,
you
exactly.
You ask Siri. Tell,
my fingers have gotten like sausage fingers, so those little buttons were tough. But for my nephew, it's perfect.
So let's start with your story. You and your brother, Jonathan, own Aurora Machine. How did that happen?
Well, I was getting out of college 2013 in January. I started getting ready. I was going to be released in May from University at Buffalo and sent him my resume for a final look before I started rifling it off to a bunch of companies in Buffalo. And he was like, you know what, man, why don't we do something together? And his background was in finance. He was working in investment banking at the time in a company in Buffalo. And he was really successful at what he was doing. And so I was looking to get into finance as well. That's what my undergraduate degree was in. And he's like, you know, I know how you're going to kind of get started and the type of manager you're going to have. He goes, you know, let's look for a business. And, you know, being in college and hearing, you know, I'm going to get out and own my own business, I was really excited. So the next step was determining what kind of business we were going to buy. He had previously owned a restaurant and he said, let's not do restaurants. There's an easier way to make money. One is the hours, you know, just the demand and, you know, when you want to be home is actually when you have to be at work, nights and weekends. And then the next thing was, retail. We want to stay away from retail. It's kind of, you know, dying at that time. So We started off basically with criteria of what not to buy and then we moved on from there. So, we cast the net originally in Buffalo, looked at a couple businesses. One was a laundromat. A chain of laundromats, and I was going to be fixing washing machines by day and, you know, doing the financing and, you know, business stuff at night. And that kind of lost its luster once we took a deeper dive into that. And moved into manufacturing when we cast the net out to Rochester and stumbled across Aurora Machine. And basically what we found is that it was operating probably like 30% capacity. It had the machines, it had the people, and it had kind of a tired owner that was really successful in early in his career. Aurora Machine is still profitable, but you know, just was you could tell it's tired, and there was a number of reasons for it, but we knew we could kind of breathe new life into it, revamp the marketing, really push the business development, and you know, push the sales. And we knew that there was going to be a problem that we could solve. So 8 months after the engagement, we ended up closing on Aurora. So in August 2013, we took ownership of it.
And when did you graduate?
May of 2013.
Okay. Were you entrepreneurial in the past? Did you start any businesses as a kid?
Yeah, exactly. So fifth grade, I was really sad when our little snack store was shut down because of new health codes and sugar in schools was not good. So naturally asked my parents to go to BJ's so I could stash up my locker, and selling gushers out of my locker and fruit roll-ups for 50 cents a roll to my classmates. So that was probably one of my earliest. And then obviously, like, you know, the lemonade thing we were doing. And then when I was in college, I noticed there was a deficiency in the market with iPhones. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to trade in your iPhone or buy a new one, it was about $200. But if you wanted to buy one off eBay, it was about $350, $400. And so there was a small gap to right there, but I knew that there was an opportunity if I could offer someone what they were going to be paying for a new one, but then turn around and sell it to someone who needed an iPhone, there was some margin to be made. So I was buying and selling probably 10 iPhones a week, you know, driving all over the place. I'm picking them up on Craigslist, selling them on eBay, and you know, hustling that way. And realized it was a lot of work for kind of a small margin. And so I wanted to get into something a bit larger. So moved into cars. And so we're buying cars kind of lower and selling them higher. And
really?
Took that model for cars and motorcycles. Yeah. So I think my brother saw that. He's 10 years older than me. And he's like, wow, you know, he's hustling, he's entrepreneurial, and you know, someone I'd want to partner with.
Is your brother active in the business today?
Yeah, he is. He's a financial, strategic, and marketing partner. So day-to-day, no, but I talk to him daily, multiple times a day sometimes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So with the cars and the phones, do you have a mechanical aptitude so that you felt comfortable with a parts business?
I wasn't raised mechanically. I didn't go to school for, you know, any engineering, but, I did do a short stint, as called Harkness, just like a trade school for auto mechanic. Cause I thought that's what I wanted to do when I got out of school, was own my own auto mechanic shop. So that kind of coincided with me buying and selling cars, and I kind of picked them up a little bit. But as far as like manufacturing and blueprints and, you know, the engineering technical side, I had no experience or exposure to it.
How did you find the business? You said, so first of all, for the audience, you are in upstate New York. It sounds like you're from the Buffalo, New York area.
You got it. Yeah. I previously mentioned my brother had a restaurant. So when he was getting ready to move back to Buffalo, he used a broker to list it and eventually sell it. That same broker was actually the listing agent of Aurora Machine. So we connected with him, and he had the Aurora listed.
The experience of working with a business broker, was that a positive one for you?
I don't think that would be our first choice. I think we really, we got a lot of progress done when we were working with the owner directly. Mm-hmm. I think for your first time, you know, it doesn't hurt to get that kind of guidance and advisement from a broker just because they're in the middle of those transactions and they're getting a lot of exposure to it. Mm-hmm. But once you have one under your belt, you kind of know how it goes and how it should look, and what you get a comfort level to do it on your own. So we've kind of explored that avenue of doing acquisitions, and mm-hmm. we've got the formula down for it. So I would feel comfortable, you know, proceeding with an acquisition without a broker.
So what I'm hearing is that a broker was helpful the first time in helping you figure out what you probably didn't know about buying a business. But once you get that under your belt, the working or searching directly might be a better choice.
Yeah, definitely. Once you're knowing the market better, you know, we were casting out a wide net, really wasn't focused on anything. So I think, you know, a broker helped us navigate that, you know, knowing us, what we were looking for, what our goals were, and kind of pairing that with an industry and eventually business.
What was your perception of manufacturing before you started looking at shops?
I think, you know, when I was in school, it was always, you know, manufacturing dead, manufacturing leaving, you know, mm-hmm. you kind of are bottom of the barrel, you know, being in manufacturing. I know it's not a profession, professional job. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we were led into. But once we actually walked around Aurora Machine and got a feel for it, it definitely told a different story. And the people that are here is, you know, they're top notch and, you know, they're professional in every way. So that quickly changed the perception.
I think also the perception of parts manufacturing is that it's a somewhat dirty business. And you look at the pictures of your shop on the website and it's incredibly clean. And I think that that's the way a lot of shops are today. So.
Yeah, we were fortunate. They actually moved Aurora into a new building 3 years before we acquired it. So everything was new and pretty and shiny and mm-hmm. really, really showed off nicely. So that helps with that perception of, you know, that being a down and dirty industry.
Describe the company when you bought it.
Well, it was small. Mm-hmm. I think the customers were lucky if they were able to get someone on the phone. The main sales guy was part-time, and the owner was basically part-time too. And that mm-hmm. was, you know, the complete administrative staff. So, you know, the culture was, you know, we do things, you know, our way, and if a customer doesn't like it, so be it kind of thing. You know, they'll get what we give them. And I think that was a really traditional look for a lot of manufacturers in our area, because they lived in the heyday of Kodak and Xerox, where it was basically, you know, how much work do you want? You know, that's right. What you had to decide. And it was just flowing all over. So I don't know if they really ever got out of that, but we came in and we're like, look, we you know, leverage this thing so we could grow it. And, you know, we needed to grow the sales in order to do that and push more to the bottom. And so we came in and updated the website, really try to, you know, update the branding and, you know, who we are and what we stood for.
And answer the phones.
Answer the phones. So when you would call, it automatically went to like three people. So if I was in the office, someone else would pick up the phone.
It makes a huge difference. And one of the things, even though Rapid became quite large, is I would not put in an automated phone answering system, because I always figured that if someone was calling, they had an immediate question or issue that they wanted to talk to someone live about. And if I created any roadblocks or hurdles for them to speak with someone, then I didn't have a customer mindset. So I think what you're saying,
sure,
just answering the phone,
yeah,
is huge.
Yeah. Definitely. I think that it sends a message to the customer that, you know, we're here. I have my personal cell phone number listed on the website, you know, call or text nights and weekends, so that they know that, you know, emergencies come up, especially, you know, the industries that we're in, and every minute matters. So if they need to get a hold of me, they have my personal cell phone.
I think that that's huge, and most people really appreciate that. Most customers will really appreciate that and won't use it, but it's nice to know that the owner will make themselves available, that they think it's that important.
Certainly. Yeah. It's, you know, it's come up with employees too, where, you know, they couldn't get a hold of someone, you know, cause they're getting in early, and so, you know, they could shoot me a message in the morning or something, you know, it was sick, or, you know, this happened. And so, yeah, just that line of communication, I think, is helpful.
When you purchased the business, how many team members came along with it?
Four.
And how did you
make
them?
Four equivalent full-time.
Yeah, how did you make them feel comfortable with you as the new owner?
Actually, for some of them, they were concerned of, like, layoffs. And so, you know, one of our first promises and commitment was, you know, there's going to be no, everyone that's here, no matter what, you're going to be here for at least a year. You know, we're going to, but our focus is to grow this thing. So, you know, hopefully this time next year, there's people around you and you know, we're a bigger company. So that helped alleviate some of the stress. But early on, you know, I had to learn the business and I had to earn the respect of the employees. So first 3 months, you know, I was on the shop floor every day, running parts, you know, sweeping up, you know, did what it took to kind of learn and earn that respect.
Are the four folks still with you today?
Besides the sales guy, yeah, everyone is still, and they all have much bigger jobs than what they had. You know, they're making more money, and, you know, our thing was, you know, we're going to grow the pie and everyone's life is going to get bigger.
That's huge. Tell me a little more about, you said they have bigger roles. How did they grow into those roles? How did you coach or give them the skills to do that? Just share a little bit of
that. Well, the manager of our precision machining department is now our director of manufacturing. And she actually, it was just a natural fit. You know, when we purchased the company, 90% of the work was flowing on the machining side. So she's always had a way of doing more with less. You know, she was, she could keep three or four machines running by herself. It was just incredible. And her energy and charisma and her ability to just, like, you know, get things done and in an orderly fashion was impressive. So we, like, you know, we need to spread this to the rest of the shop. So probably within 2 years of us taking over, she went from just the machining to managing the entire shop. You know, more of an operator, was actually her son on the machining side. And now he's managing the, machining side. So he's grown into that position. 20 off her other son, it was very much a family business. He was a machine operator, and now he's a leader of all of our programming. So whether it's, you know, in the laser, the press brake, you know, he's doing all the programming and CAD work.
Before we got started with the podcast here, you were telling me that in the beginning, the company was really operating on a month-to-month basis, and the customers were siloed with your different capabilities. You can describe this a little more, but you have machining capabilities, you had sheet metal capabilities, you had powder coating capabilities. So you got to know the business in the first 3 months. Then how did you start making changes? What directed you to make the changes? How did you start to piece together who you wanted Aurora to be?
Yeah, that was, you know, trial and error, at the first part. So it was like, you know, what's, you know, going through the marketing and the branding is, you know, why are we special? What's our differentiator? Why are customers choosing us over our competitors?
How did you find that out?
Talking to the current customers. So we had a healthy customer base where we could talk to them and be like, you know, did you know that we offered machining? Like, no, we didn't know that. Or, you know, sheet metal or powder coating, you know, and just doing those cross-selling activities. We're like, wow, you know, this customer is really showing us a lot of activity, whether it's on the quote side or order side, and because they're appreciating that they can go to one place. Part of like the reshoring and resourcing, and when that was kind of all that work was coming back, you know, early 2013, 2014, a lot of companies' focus we were hearing was vendor consolidation. So they wanted to work with less vendors and put more with those vendors. And we're like, well, we're a perfect fit because you don't have to go to a different sheet metal house. You don't have to go to a machining house. You don't have to send it out to a third party powder coater. You know, we can integrate all those capabilities under one roof.
Were you working with a variety of industries, and have you since focused or narrowed your area that you at least target the marketing to?
Yeah. So, we realized, you know, they were, touching your earlier point, we were living, you know, kind of month to month, you know, we were only as good as our last orders, more of a, you know, that job shop type environment. And with our focus to grow, we realized it was going to be difficult to invest in the company with not knowing really what the next order, year looked like. So we had to focus our efforts on, companies that had repeat products that we could basically engage those product lines and get longer visibility on what we were producing and what our potential sales could be for that month. So we narrowed it down into the rail industry and machine builders. And the rail was like 2 to 3 year contracts. And machine builders, they can give us blanket orders basically for their year, for their fiscal year. So with extending that, we are like, okay, we've got this order for the next, you know, 8-9 months, and every month is filled up to this thing. Like, this is what our capacity is for this machine. We don't have enough. Let's go buy another machine. You know, we have the orders on the books. And, you know, through that confidence of those orders, we really could make big investments in the company with confidence.
So the machine builders, they can use all the capabilities of your facility?
Yeah, that was the other hinge point, was we needed to figure out how we could get customers to utilize all of our capabilities, because if they do, we're going to be able to offer, you know, better lead times, better quality, and a better price, keeping it all under one roof. And the customers that we inherited, it was, you know, they're either using our machining capability, or they're using our sheet metal or the powder coating, and they weren't really doing any cross-functional capabilities. So we turned to, you know, the marketing strategy of, you know, who's going to use all of our capabilities in one shot, you know, what type of products would do that. And so we found the rail, they have machining and sheet metal requirements with finishing, and machine builders. So, you know, example for the machine builders, you have the skins, the enclosures on the outside, you have the internal frame structure, you have machined little widgets inside and trinkets. So it was a perfect match.
And how does the rail industry fit in?
There's a lot of machine components underneath the car. So the bogie is like where the trucks, so there's more turned and milled parts there. And the interiors, you know, you're looking at like the walls and, you know, brackets inside and cable trays, you know, it's all sheet metal.
Gotcha. So when you went out to customers, they're consolidating their vendor base. What did they tell you why they liked Aurora and why they wanted to keep you as a supplier and not knock you off the list?
Those multiple capabilities. You know, they realized they could do more with less with us. And I think that they become you know, instead of having a small account with many vendors, you know, they're consolidating it and they're being a bigger piece of the pie here, and more important, and they're getting, you know, they're hoping to be, you know, get more attention and love.
Did they ever mention hitting delivery dates or quality or other aspects of customer service?
Sure. Yeah. You know, obviously everyone just kind of assumes quality. But I think what we would express to them is there's not going to be finger pointing. You know, you have like a sheet metal supplier who's then, you know, the customer is then facilitating the finishing, you know, and there's a scratch or a ding in the paint, you're getting a finger pointing. And, you know, what we're saying to the customers, you know, you're not going to have that issue. It's all in one shop. So, you know, if there's a ding in the paint, we know who did it. It's us. And, you know, we'll take care of it and make it right.
Gotcha. You also are very large in your certified welding capabilities. And that didn't exist when you bought the shop, did it?
No, it didn't. And that's really a big hurdle getting into the rail industry. That's their, you know, requirement. If you want to do any welding and if you want to do any big stuff, you have to do welding. Otherwise, you're just doing little simple brackets. So we first start off with steel and, you know, eventually into stainless and then aluminum. And, you know, then there's MIG and TIG and different thicknesses. So I think now we have probably like 15 or 20 certifications for the welding. Yeah.
Were they patient and helpful in you getting into the certified welding, or did they just say this is an opportunity and leave it up to you to make it happen?
Yes and no. The company I'm thinking of in particular, you know, they're a global multinational company with big resources. And they certainly weren't just handing it out, but they did offer resources and guidance to help us get there. And once they saw that we were serious about it, they were kind of new to this area, relatively new to this area, and they were trying to build out their supply base. So, you know, they were going to pick a handful of companies that they were going to invest their time and resources into, and we were fortunate to be at the top of the list. And, you know, this is where you have to go, this is what you need, and help us walk through that process.
Do you have challenges finding qualified welders? That's not an easy skill set to necessarily find.
No. You know, and it's funny. Finding the first five welders was an enormous challenge. It seemed like we, you know, just never had enough welders, and the ones we were finding weren't good, and, you know, there was high turnover in that area. But once finding that first five, you know, and now we're up to 11 welders, it was like a snap of the finger, because those five guys were highly qualified, very skilled, and they had friends in other areas. They got a taste of all our culture and the type of people we were and what we're trying to do, and they really grabbed onto it. So, you know, they were inviting their friends like, hey, you know, you got to check this place out. It's different. It's unique. It's special. And so, you know, now we're up to 11 welders.
11 welders, wow.
With the one CWI. So, you know, you're seeing finding those qualified people. You know, not everyone comes with those certifications, but with our in-house CWI.
What is this? What is that, CWI?
Yeah, Certified Welding Instructor.
So you are able to certify welders in-house?
Yep.
That's
so certain tests. So, yeah, there's a PQR and a WPS. PQR is the process qualification. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to qualify a process, you have to send it out to a third party for lab testing, but the CWI has to facilitate you know, the certification. And then once you have that process and you're just certifying the welders to your externally, you know, third party tested results, then you can qualify welders internally.
That must be a big advantage then. Yeah,
definitely.
So you mentioned that they were telling their friends about your shop and about the culture, just a better place to work. What do you think makes Aurora a better place to work than the shop down the street who is advertising for a welder?
Well, some of the feedback that we're getting is, you know, it's not micromanaged. The people who are bringing in or bringing them in because, you know, we trust them and, you know, they have a specialty skill and what they're good at. And so, you know, we're hands off day to day and we're just say, how can we make your job easier? You know, is your machine okay? Is your workstation all right? You know, what can we do to support you? And, you know, we're not managing them minute by minute, like, hey, you have to get this part out now. We're really focused on a macro level. You know, this is what we have to get to every month. These are our customers' expectations. You know, how do we get there together? So it's definitely a collaborative approach rather than finger pointing or, you know, badgering type thing.
And you have an air conditioned shop too, right?
Yes, in the summer that really does help. Keeps the morale up.
Sure.
It's all climate controlled. So yeah, that helps.
You make it sound so basic, Jordan, but just listening to your team members and asking the questions, how can you make their life a little easier? What can you do with their workstation that will help them do their job better? That's huge. And I remember a lesson I learned early on at Rapid where we were not in an air-conditioned shop. This is the machining portion. And it was pretty hot in the summer. So I bought a big pedestal fan that I was put near the work center on one of the machining stations. And the machinist there was so grateful for that. And for me, I didn't understand why, but what he shared with me was that he'd worked for 10 years before in the shop and there were never any fans in the shop and the owner didn't want to spend $150 to make the life of the machinist better. So those little things are huge and they definitely bring a loyalty to the shop, and I think that you're on the right track. And obviously the fact that you have a team that are bringing in other folks who they know says that you are doing things the right way. So kudos to you there.
Appreciate that. Yeah. Our director of manufacturing, she's on it. She's really in tune with, you know, not only people's like needs inside of work too, it's, you know, outside. And I think, you know, that type of employee engagement where, you know, there's kind of know that they're cared for, you know, not only in work, but outside of work. And, you know, if there's something that we can do above and beyond, you know, we'd love to help and offer that.
Can you give me some examples of things that might have come up where we've been able to help folks outside of work?
So I'm not in the shop minute by minute, but our director of manufacturing is. And so we actually give her, we call it employee engagement allowance. Mm-hmm. So whether it's, you know, issuing a bonus to somebody, taking someone out to go get groceries, buying them clothes, or even diapers in some cases, you know, all those types of things, or doing a luncheon. So, you know, we've done the barbecues and grill outs, and we like to have fun with setting goals. So, you know, above the employee engagement, you know, we'll set a goal like, hey, you know, if we hit this threshold, you know, or this goal, you know, this is what we're going to do for everyone. So just to keep things interesting, keep them motivated, and, you know, know what's going on in the business.
So if I understand correctly, you are providing her with some discretionary funds so that she can use them as she sees fit for helping team members, whether inside or outside work.
You got it. Yep.
Are you comfortable sharing what that amount is? Or maybe you could frame it in a way so that the audience could understand the level of commitment that they might be able to make for their shops.
Yeah, I mean, it's, it's correlated to the number of employees. So, you know, mm-hmm. kind of as we grow, you know, you want that fund or allowance to grow with it. Mm-hmm. But it's nothing ginormous, but it's enough to let the employee know that we're thankful for them, that we appreciate them, and, you know, we're here for them. Like I said, it's as simple as sometimes a lunch or, you know, it could be groceries or diapers. So, and that's just and it's just a rolling thing. So, at first it was kind of used up, monthly, but now it's just kind of culminates, at the end and, it could be dispersed anyway. And we tell her too, like, you know, you could take it for yourself. You know, she hasn't taken it once for herself, but, we're just like, it's, you know, however you'd like to use it, you can.
And you don't micromanage it? You don't ask for any reporting?
No. I mean, I see it. She has a credit card, but, you know, sometimes it's through payroll. But no, I don't. I mean, she always lets me know kind of, you know, if there's something going on, but, I let her. You know, when you're in those situations, when you're talking to someone and they're like, I don't have, money for groceries this week. Like, you know, she got to stop the conversation, come up to ask me if she can go get groceries for this person. Like, no, just, you know, she's very, she's done good with that responsibility.
So you've grown from 4 to 40 team members. And I think that this is a perfect example of how an owner needs to think, in the sense that they have to get away from the micromanaging, get away from knowing everything and controlling everything, to trusting their team members to do the right thing. And knowing that perhaps you would times disagree with what they're doing, but at the same time, you are making it their decision and you're not going to overrule their decision or otherwise let them know that you don't think that they're doing a good job. You let it happen, and there's a lot of really positive benefits that come out of that.
Yeah, definitely. It's, it's come up multiple times where they're just so grateful and, you know, they say, you know, this place is different. And, I know that, that has a way of coming around, and, it should be a full circle. So, we're happy to do it. And, you know, we give without any type of, you know, reciprocation, expectation. Hopefully they do it for someone else, or, you know, that, you know, they really feel, you know, loved and cared for here.
Mm-hmm. I saw on the website that the training is done the Aurora way, and that probably feeds into what we're talking about. But could you describe what the Aurora way is?
We were going to put on the website actually, like, it's okay to fail, or, screw up a part. We're okay with that. It was kind of tough to say that on the website, like, especially if, like, your customer's perspective, like, but I think what in putting more context to that, you know, if there's a certain feature, like one part, you know, an operator is going to, you know, hit go on, and, you know, they're scared to do it because they don't want to mess up the part. You know, it's usually done within a controlled area. You know, like, if they mess up this one part, like, it's okay. But, you know, we're not yelling at people if they screw up parts. You know, it's, you know, what happens? Okay, you know, did we learn from it? Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Let's get new parts made. Or, you know, rarely is there ever a situation where it's like, oh my gosh, now we're going to be late, and, you know, you messed up everything, and, you know, that just doesn't happen. It's just, it's more supportive. And if you're not trying new things and if you're not failing, you're not moving to the next level. Not only from the employee aspect, from an Aurora prospect, if we're not trying new things and trying to be innovative, we're not moving to the next level. So that's how we think that we can get to the next level is failing. That's okay.
So again, very rapid growth at Aurora. And for the listener, these are some great ideas to think about and look at. Does this culture exist in your shop? How are failures treated within your own organization? And particularly if you are trying to grow, is your culture helping or impeding you in the growth? And what I am hearing here, Jordan, is that the culture is a huge part of enabling the growth at Aurora.
Yeah, definitely. You hear it all over the place. People can't find good employees, but I think you have to look internally. How do you treat your current employees? And you can't grow without adding good people and skilled labor. So, if you're doing all the right things and you're treating them right, they have a way of, knowing other people in the industry and, bringing them along. So we've been playing catch up, just trying to find the right people. And it seems like we're finally now, after many years, at kind of a stabilized level with, not only having, our current employees matching what our output is, but having a bench of kind of employees, potential employees ready to go when we do get the next big order.
Are you opportunistic in your hiring? And what I mean by that is if you come across someone where you may not have a perfect fit for them, but you like their attitude and their skill set, do you hire them figuring you're going to grow into their abilities or into their skill set?
Definitely. We value personality and the soft skills equally to that of the skill set. So you might be like the best welder, fabricator, but if your personality is crap and you treat others around you like crap, you're not going to be joining our team. And those people have either aren't hired or kind of quickly asked to leave. So that we place the equal weight and value on both of those.
So with this rapid growth, what have been some of the challenges along the way that surprised you?
I think one of our first ones was, oh my gosh, we're killing it. We're jamming out so much, but why don't we have any cash? we bought the business. We didn't buy any of the receivables and minimal kind of working capital. So that was one of our first things we had to solve. And, we need this much for receivables. This is our WIP, our finished inventory, our raw material that we have to kind of carry to support, these bigger numbers. So fortunately, my brother's main job is he's in wealth management. He works a lot with banks and, he gets that picture and he manages those, relationships, with our banks. So that, when we do get in a big order or, we're ready to get a new machine, we're well capitalized to do so. But, we were kind of blindsided. We're like, what is going on? We're shipping out all this stuff. Our income statement says we made this much money, but it's not in our account. Of course, it's sitting out in the receivables and inventory. So it continues to be the case, as we grow, those two areas, require more financing or, cash. And, fortunately, my brother is, kind of well aware and in tune with that.
That's a great point. And it's not real obvious because on your profit and loss statement, as you said, it looks like you're making lots of money, but your cash is actually tied up in receivables. You've had to pay for materials, obviously the labor that's gone into the work and process on the floor. So cash is king, as a mentor of mine always told me. And if you are going to grow, the faster you grow, the more cash you will need to support that growth. And I think that that's a super observation to bring up. How about any other challenges that you hadn't foreseen?
Other challenges? Sometimes the sales cycle with customers. So, you know, it's not just, oh, we can do this. Oh, here's a whole bunch of orders. There you go, kind of thing. I think there's a long courting period. So, you know, you have to make sure that you always have irons in the fire, the pipeline is full, and you have kind of a customer ready to step in any moment if you want to continue to grow. The last thing you want to do is kind of expand your capacity. And then, you know, one of your main customers or second main customer slows down and there's nothing to fill it. It's kind of the worst case scenario. So, you know, always being talking to new prospects, you know, even if you're busy, you know, keep those conversations warm and, just like them, you know, referring to earlier, the virtual, bench, and you want to have a virtual bench of customers too, not only of employees, but customers.
That's another great point. In my experience is shop owners, in many cases, don't start looking for business until they need it. And what I'm hearing is that you are always looking for business because you never know when you may lose business from an existing customer. And of course, sure. If you want to grow, you need to add more customers. But the time to look for business is not when you need it.
No, it's too late.
Yeah.
But, you know, having those contracts and you know, scheduled out months, you know, we know months ahead of time that, okay, like, you know, this is looking slow. Let's, you know, push this or talk to this customer or, you know, we're looking really busy. You know, don't, you know, raise prices or, you know, just try to defer any type of new work for a couple months kind of thing. So we can meet our commitments.
I want to go back to, you said in the beginning you were marketing. What specific marketing and sales tools did you use to get in front of new customers? And beyond conversations, have current customers become more aware of your capabilities?
You know, when we became more focused on a couple industries of what we wanted to play in and support, we, you know who the big players are. They're just kind of around town. You know, we're not a national organization by any means. We're selling within, you know, a couple hundred miles. So just kind of nature of being out there and beating the bushes, you know who to talk to and, you know, what type of work is out there. There's nothing really ever formalized.
Did you email them? Did you send them physical mail? How did you get in front of the people you identified?
Yeah, at the beginning, it was just kind of, you know, let's throw things at the wall and see what sticks, you know, who's kind of responding to us. So, you know, we did try mailers, a lot of phone calls, you know, just on the phone. Probably the first year I was on the phone every day, you know, calling and building up that pipeline, getting those irons in the fire. And actually just last year, it was one of my first reach outs. They finally said, okay, we're going to give you a chance and give us an opportunity. But, you know, it took 5 years. You know, that's just one example. But, you know, showing up with the donuts, you know, on a routine basis, coffee, you know, getting them out to lunch and, you know, building up those relationships, because, you know, our business is very much, you know, relationship driven, and, you know, it's with that person, with that company. But, you know, with sometimes, you know, those buyers have a tendency to move around and jump from company to company, and in many ways doing the same things they were doing just for someone else. So
that's very helpful, I think, for owners to think that it's a long game, that if you want to bring on a target customer, it's not going to happen in 3 months. It's going to take possibly years, 5 years in that case, as you mentioned, to court and demonstrate to a customer that you are a good shop and to give you a chance. So thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome.
One of the things that you had mentioned, and I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about automation at Aurora, and you use the phrase automate the administrative tasks. What's behind that?
We have a small, relatively small administrative team. So anytime we can automate repetitive tasks so that they can work more on the business than in the business, we're all for it. So one of the scenarios was we added a Fastenal vending machine so that, you know, for those lower cost items that we're constantly reordering, always short, you know, never have enough. We looked at the true cost of that, not only from money standpoint, but from a time, you know, we generating that requisition and placing the order, receiving that order in, and, you know, getting it stocked, putting it into our system. Our operations coordinator was spending a lot of time with that. And so we engaged Fastenal, and we said, look, these are these items that we're going through a lot of, and we want to have them basically on demand and for you guys to manage it. So, you know, our POs, you know, estimate we're cutting 150 to 200 a year on these supplies. You know, now we're down to one or two. Yeah.
Wow. And what sort of supplies are in the vending machine?
It's supporting all of the different departments. So for milling, you know, you have different drill bits, countersinks, different types of tooling like that. You have gloves, eyeglasses, there's stuff for welding, so welding consumables for them. Deburring, there's a whole bunch.
And
we're stocking about 150 SKUs.
So you have 150. Do you have just one vending machine, or do you have several on the floor?
Three. There's basically two automated machines, and then there's one shelf,
so
which is replenished.
For people who don't understand how a vending machine is automatically restocked, can you just go through that process?
Yeah, the vendor basically comes once a week, and the machine is connected through our internet and sends them reports of what items are used. Our operations coordinator just set mins on those, and so when the inventory reaches them in, they're in here restocking, and, you know, they're you know, saying like, hey, you guys are using a lot of this, you know, did you try this one? You know, and it really kind of builds that relationship with the vendor, and, you know, in the end, I think we're getting way better service than what we were before. And I think we're getting, you know, better products for our applications, because they're understanding like, hey, you're using, you know, a lot of these, you know, maybe you should step up to the next, you know, brand, and, you know, a little bit more expensive, but you'll probably use less of them and save money. So, you know, things like that, those types of conversations, I think are healthy.
I love that, because here's a great example of the term data is thrown around in the industry, and how do we use data to improve our processes? And most people are thinking more at the machine level, which certainly there's opportunities there. But here you are essentially sharing your buying patterns in a much more detailed manner with your supplier. And now they have the data to help you in ways that you just wouldn't be able to have those conversations before. So not only do you save all those purchase orders, but you're potentially getting products that are more suited for your specific shop. And I would assume that there's some cost savings there as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the real sexy to talk about, you know, $1 deburring pad, but, you know, when you've got a thousand of them and, you know, and you're going through them every month, and the conversation gets more interesting when you're putting those all in one place.
Huge. What other sort of administrative tasks have you automated? Can you give some examples?
Paperless parts, that's been a huge automation for us. Just one, when we're doing complex assemblies, it's automatically breaking out that entire BOM and giving us detail, like, you know, the first set of eyes on that. That's been a huge step up for us as we continue to invest in, you know, building out the algorithm to fit our pricing structure. It's, you can see it kind of removing those tedious, repetitive tasks.
Can you talk a little bit more in depth on how it works with assemblies and BOMs for you?
Yeah. You know, sometimes we'll get a drawing that is going to have, you know, 10 different pieces of hardware, 10 different subcomponents. In some cases, those have subcomponents. And so with uploading that top-level assembly, it's going to give you a price breakdown at that subcomponent level, so that when you do see a piece of hardware, you just kind of, it either will acknowledge it as, or you can just change the process to recognize it as, and you know, material. You know, when you're getting those onesie twosies, and it's automatically telling you, hey, this is the price at McMaster Car. You know, you're just not jumping around like window to window trying to find those, or if it's online metals. So little things like that kind of add up to be big, you know, especially when you're doing a higher volume, it all adds up.
And how are you dialing in the pricing algorithms for the paperless parts quoting platform?
We're doing side by side kind of how we were quoting before and with doing paperless and trying to refine it. Like, okay, you know, it seems like, you know, machining components are good. It seems like, you know, we've got that tied in, but anytime we have a machine component with a turn part in it, you know, that's where we're getting tripped up. Okay. Like, why is it getting tripped up? And, you know, the team at paperless is highly responsive and, you know, supportive to dig into those scenarios and, you know, peel back the onion.
So it sounds like the advantage, or one of the advantages, that you're saving a lot of time in the setting up of quotes. As you said, you're not going from screen to screen filling in information. It's all in one place.
Mm-hmm. You got it. I think, you know, obviously the end zone for us is to get the customer to interact with our online template on our website to then, you know, use that paperless and, you know, generate their price instantly. You know, we're not there yet, but, you know, that's where we're hoping to get to at one point.
Any other comments or thoughts on how you can use automation in other places in the shop, or just your philosophy on automating? And as I think you said before, instead of being reactive, using automation to make you proactive.
Yeah, you got it. So, you know, we're, you know, like I said, administratively, we have a small team. So, you know, we want people, you know, working on the day, not in the day, and, you know, reacting to the fire. So we're trying to alleviate those scenarios and saying like, okay, well, you know, it's worth having a few of those things on the shelf, or, you know, putting in the vending machine so that we're not having to, you know, scramble to get them shipped in here. And, you know, the machine is sitting, the operator is waiting. So, you know, that's the scenario. But really on the software side too, we've invested heavily into our Amod equipment lineup in sheet metal. And one of their products that they offer is SheetWorks. And that basically would take a CAD file, unfolds it, programs it. And really, the programmer is just verifying everything at every level. You know, for a good portion of the parts, you know, you always get those corrupted CAD files that you have to spend time with. But, you know, if the part is drawn properly, you know, you should just be able to click through it. The development and get it to the shop, you know, that much faster in production, that much faster. So at every turn, you know, you kind of think of automation with in the manufacturing industry on machines, but, you know, we're trying to automate those administrative tasks as well.
So one of the ways that I have seen you automate is your customer interactions. And I want to, we're getting close to where we should wrap up, but you have just launched a new website and you have a chat feature on there. So why did you decide to put in a chat feature, and has it been used by customers, and how do they do it?
Yeah. Funny enough, the first day we launched that, that was used by one of our, a potentially large customer. And it was an engineer, and he was wondering how he can get a quote over to us. So I think that's just all part of just being responsive, putting the customer first, as you said, you know, picking up the phone. And I think this is just kind of a new way to reach out to that customers and have that direct line to me or someone else on the team. It's important for them to know that, you know, we're here for them.
So would you recommend to other shop owners they incorporate chat into their website?
Yeah, I would.
Another very slick part of your website is the video of your tube laser. So that is a very slick machine. How much did that cost, and how did you justify it?
I believe the price tag was around $1 million. And how we justified it was really the add-on of that tube portion. It's a hybrid machine. So we, not only can we do tube, but we can also do flat. And the marginal increase of the cost of the machine was something that we could justify with filling up only about 30% of that machine with tube work. Internally, we looked at our contracts of what we could have to support that, and we were pretty close to that number. So with that new capability, it was also a differentiator for us, really something unique that not a lot of companies offer. So we felt that we could fill most of it up internally with ongoing work, but now we have something really to market and push and potentially acquire new customers with. And offer our current customers more capability and capacity.
Yeah, that is a, we looked at it. We could not justify purchasing one at Rapid, but the capabilities and the time savings are just huge in using a laser to put in holes as opposed to setting up in a machining center.
So, you got it. Yeah.
Question I have, when you are purchasing, you said $1 million, huge amount of money for any shop, but particularly for a smaller shop, do you create a business plan for that piece of equipment? Do you put down numbers on paper? Do you create a document that outlines the purchase, or is it more gut and intuition?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think it was more of back of a napkin type thing. And because it's, you know, you're estimating and you're guessing, you're hoping. And, you know, I think we had enough work internally to kind of support that and justify the purchase. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, just being sales development and, you know, business development, looking at, you know, okay, what does this mean, you know, for Aurora to offer this capability now to our current customers and potentially new ones? And does that open up more channels for us, revenue channels? And we quickly realized that there's not a lot of them out there. It's a specialty piece of equipment, and mm-hmm. it could make us better, faster, and more competitive. So it made it an easy decision.
One last question before we do wrap it up here. If you had a billboard on Interstate 90 advertising your services, what would it say?
One-stop shop metal manufacturing.
Love it. Love it. Well, this has been a super conversation, Jordan. I really appreciate it. And I think that your story is a great one to be shared with our audience. The growth and success that you've had over the past 6 years, from two brothers who were not from the industry, you have applied common sense and practical business philosophies to custom manufacturing, and you have, beyond making it work, you have made it hugely successful. So I'm sure our listeners have picked up some ideas that can help them grow and find their niche in the manufacturing world. Do you have any last comments?
No, but if any of the listeners, you know, have any further questions for me, you know, obviously, please reach out to the website and you'll have all of my contact information there.
And they can chat with you online.
You got it. Yeah, they could test it out.
Yeah. All right. Listeners, please check out the show notes on our website, thejobshopshow.com. Shoot us any feedback, any criticisms, comments. Leave us a review, email us, and until next time, thanks for listening and keep those spindles turning.